I'll get us started, because I do have a question. Now, brother, just help me make sure that I understand this correctly. In old Israelite slavery, if you were an indentured servant and you were being mistreated, you could run away, and that was legal. So if New World slavery is closer to kidnapping, we certainly would believe someone who was kidnapped could morally run away from their kidnapper. You believe it would have been morally acceptable for slaves in America to run away just by virtue of the fact that it was an unscriptural arrangement?
Yeah. I do think so. And the closest concept maybe for us today would be something like sex trafficking. That would be probably closer to New World slavery than biblical slavery. In sex trafficking, you know, young girls and sometimes young boys are kidnapped or taken from their homes. They're shipped to, most often they're shipped to a foreign country, but not necessarily. Sometimes it happens in the country in which they were born. And they are forced into performing all manner of unspeakable things. And I don't think that there's anything in the Bible that would say that a person in that condition has to remain in that condition. And I think the same could be said for New World slavery. The Bible absolutely condemns the practice of New World slavery. And when the apostles wrote that servants were to remain with their masters, I don't think they ever intended anything like New World slavery to be where a person would remain. And so I wouldn't have any problem agreeing with what you said, yeah.
We have a question, but one more follow-up to that. How do you harmonize Moses' allowance to run away from an abusive master with Peter's command to stay with an abusive master?
Well, I think we have to really remember the reason that Peter gives that command. And I didn't have a whole lot of time to spend over there, but if you look, let's look over at 1 Peter, if you all want to grab a Bible. So we read from 1 Peter 2. In 1 Peter 2, Peter says, be submissive to the government, even if the government is unruly. Be submissive to your masters, even if the master is unruly. And he talks about Jesus, our example of suffering. But when you get to chapter 3, look in 1 Peter chapter 3. And he's focusing here on wives. I'm going to read beginning in verse 1. Wives, likewise, and notice the word likewise. Likewise connects the thematic idea of this paragraph with what we've been reading about. So wives, likewise, in the same way Christians submit to government, in the same way slaves submit to their masters, wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, even if they're unruly, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. I think Peter's idea is that the reason the servant stays in the place where he is so that he can be a living testimony to Jesus Christ. And I think that's why Peter says, even if you have to endure hardships as a Christian, you ought to stay where you are so that your faith can be seen by others.
Dalton Smith.
Excellent lesson. I have a question about old world slavery. And you compared old world slavery to possibly a sports contract. And going with that analogy, sports contracts, you know, a player can be transferred to another team, but they didn't have to pay the player whatever was agreed upon by the previous team. Is that the same with old world slavery, where one slave could be transferred to another master? I mean, in any way, because it's not that at all.
No, I didn't mean to say that the two ideas were analogous. All I meant to say was the term, we still use this terminology today. We say a team is going to buy a player. That doesn't mean the player has the status of property like cattle. It's just the terminology, the lingo. So when we see in the Old Testament, the scripture says, if you buy a Hebrew servant, It doesn't mean that the servant is cattle, property. It's just accommodative terminology saying the servant has sold himself into your service, and so you are buying the contract, not the human being. You're buying the terms of service.
So could one master sell the slave to another master?
I don't know of any occasion where that's permitted. I do know of occasions where that's forbidden. That's forbidden in Exodus 21 with the woman who is to be a wife and a servant, and she's not allowed to be sold to another household. It's expressly forbidden, and I'm not familiar with a passage that allows that. Now, if the servant wanted to do that, if he said, "Listen, I would like to go serve this other household, can my contract be transferred?" Maybe it would have been allowable, but I don't know of a passage which expressly speaks to that.
Okay, and also with numeral slavery, with the example with Philemon and Onesimus, could Philemon ever sell Onesimus? Because, I don't remember the word, but I think you said Matthew, you said that it was sinful, Corinthians, for a Christian to be a slave dealer. A kidnapper.
1 Timothy 1, yeah.
Okay. Pauline epistles.
Yeah.
So would that be sinful as well for a Philemon to sell Onesimus? Because, you could liken that to slave dealing.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about that particular practice, but that's similar to the idea. I'd have to think about that some more though, Dalton. I'm not really sure about that.
Michael Conway.
Really enjoyed that. You said that all of the old world was voluntary. Now, this may have led into what Brother Jerry is going to teach on tonight as well. But going back to Exodus 21 and verse 7, she started out and said, if a man sells his daughter to be a female slave, and then it continues on down, is she voluntarily doing that as well? Or is that just the law that requires her to do so?
Yeah. So this is an issue of arranged marriages, okay? And this is Jerry Dickinson's topic. I don't mean to dodge, but I'm going to partially dodge. There's no evidence in the text that the woman is forced. There's no evidence for that. And Jewish marriage customs generally were that a young man and a young woman would desire to be married, and so they would go to the heads of their households and say, "We want to be married," and the heads of the households would then begin the negotiations. And I had up a slide about the bride price, but I didn't read it. I just threw that slide up because I was really hoping that I could just defer half my questions to Jerry, honestly. The bride price was for the wife's protection. Okay, so the heads of family would get together and they would start negotiations. And it wasn't a dowry system. In a dowry system, the wife's or the bride's family pays money to the husband's family. That's like how it is in India in arranged marriage. This was the opposite. The husband's family paid the bride's family the bride price. And that money was set aside and saved for two possible scenarios: divorce or the death of the husband. And so if the wife, years later, finds herself single again because she's gotten a divorce or her husband has died, the bride price money was given to her so she'd have something to live on. That was for her to use to provide for her sustenance. So to answer your question, marriages in ancient Israel were arranged. But according to a lot of sources like the Talmud, the marriages were initiated by the young man and the young woman who wanted to get married. But the negotiations were made by the heads of their family. So I don't think that she's being forced. And there's no evidence in Exodus 21 that says she's being forced.
You did a good job of explaining the protections offered to slaves. I've got a question. And 2 Samuel chapter 12, Joab captures a city in Ammon, and David puts the people to work. He says he brought out the people who were in it and put them to work with saws and iron picks and iron axes and made them cross over the brickworks. And so he did to all the cities the people of Ammon. Then David and all the people returned to Jerusalem. How were those protections afforded, if they were, to these people? Can you elaborate on this verse?
So here's an interesting fact that I learned about prisoners of war. There's no mention that I'm really aware of where prisoners of war were taken into individual households as servants. You have the examples of prisoners of war who were taken by the nation and they served to build the temple and those kinds of things. They served the nation in some way. But I gave the general precept that I think that all of the protections that are mentioned throughout the law of Moses were given both to Israelites and to non-Israelites. And the passage that I used for that, I think, was from the book of Leviticus, if I can scroll back up here in my notes. Leviticus 19, 33 and 34. And Moses there says, if there's a foreigner in your land, you treat him just like you treat someone who was born among your own people. You shall love him as yourself, verse 34 says. And the reason that Moses gives, and I love this because a lot of the times when this issue is dealt with in the law of Moses, Moses says, don't forget, not too long ago, you were slaves also. And so you be careful how you treat other people. You were treated poorly and you don't want to do that to somebody else. And so he gives that reminder here. You were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. And that is all over in the Old Testament. And I think, you know, that's why servants were included in the fourth commandment. The Israelites had no rest in Egypt. They had bitter toil. But on the Sabbath, everyone in Israel rested, even the foreigners. And that's built right into the Ten Commandments. So the oppressive style of slavery that was common in other parts of the ancient world and that was common in New World slavery is nowhere in the law of Moses. It just doesn't exist.
Nate Bibbins.
Thank you, Shaw. Hey, that was very interesting. And wondered if you had time to study just a couple other verses that sometimes are used by individuals to try and slander the Old Testament that are difficult upon first reading. In Exodus 21, verse 20, of course, states that if a man beats his male or female servant and robs it, he dies under his hand, he shall surely be punished. The next verse says, notwithstanding, if he remains alive for a day or two, he shall not be punished, for he is his property. And then also a few verses down in verse 32, another one that's difficult after talking about the ox that gores an individual,
right.
And of course, if it was known to gore, there were punishments. But it says, whether it gored a son or gored a daughter, according to his judgment, it shall be done to him. In verse 32, if the ox gores a male or female servant, he shall give to the master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. And some have alleged in that second part, there was less worth for a servant being gored that could just be paid off by money than other individuals. Wonder if you could
be happy to. If you have a Bible, go to Exodus 21. Okay, let's start in Exodus 21 in verse 18. Now, what we have here in this section of Exodus 21 are a series of laws which deal with things that should have never happened, but if they did happen, here's what you need to do to remedy the situation. So I want you to know that first of all, and that's why we're going to start reading in Exodus 21, verse 18. If men have a quarrel and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, and he does not die but remains in bed, if he gets up and walks around outside on his staff, then he who struck him shall go unpunished. He shall only pay for his loss of time and shall take care of him until he is completely healed. Now let's pause there. Does this mean that the law of Moses permitted brawling? Well, of course not. That was not the point. The point was not go ahead and fight it out, duke it out with each other, and then just settle up later at the end. You have the same thing after this, where some people are fighting and a pregnant woman is injured and loses the child. No one wants that to happen. But if it does happen, here is how you deal with it. If this unfortunate situation occurs, here's how to deal with it. So that's the context of this passage. So let's read again, now that you all have your Bibles open, verses 20 and 21. If a man strikes his male or female slave, that's not an endorsement. I say, okay, if this happens with a rod and he dies at his hand, he shall be punished. Now let's pause there. The word punished is nakam, and punished is a bad translation. This word should be translated avenged. And every other time it's used in the New King James Version, it's translated avenged. And in almost every other context, it's referring to the death penalty. Which is why I read from a different version when I quoted this that said, death is the penalty for anyone who beats his servant to death. So that's the first part, okay? If you beat your servant to death, that's a human being and you're going to be executed. If, verse 21, however, he survives a day or two, no vengeance shall be taken, for he is his property. Now, we've got to deal with this. Because the word property is a bad translation. It's a bad translation. The Hebrew word is keseth, and it's the normal word for silver, which is why the Old King James and the English Standard Version say money. Not he is property, he is his money. And I think what we have in this verse is the same idea we just had. If a couple of men get in a brawl and one of them loses time from work because of it, the other one has to pay him back for that. If a servant is not working, then the master is losing money. And so there's an assumption in this law. And the assumption is that the punishment that is going to come to the employer is a loss of money. In other words, it's not profitable for you to beat your servants, causing them to be unable to work. You're going to lose money. Now, that might not seem like enough of a punishment, but one thing you need to know about this whole section in the book of Exodus is that all of these matters were taken to judges. So we have in Exodus 21 and verse 6, his master shall bring him before the judges. You have verse 22, he shall pay as the judges determine. You have verse chapter 22 and verse 8, where a thief is brought to the judges. And so if an Israelite man beats his servant and injures him, the matter was taken to judges to determine appropriate punishment. The assumption is you're not going to want to do this because you're going to lose money, you're going to lose productivity. But I think ultimately all these cases were probably brought to the judges. Now, you had another question about verse 30-something. Oh, the ox. Okay, I think it's the same thing here. It's the same thing here. So, if your children are injured, you're not losing money. Sorry, kids. You know, we love you. All children are wonderful. I'm glad you're all here. But if your kid is injured, you're not losing money. If your servant is injured, you're losing money. And so I think that's why the financial restitution is included for the servant. It's not saying this is all the servant is worth. Can I have a pet peeve moment? I don't know that we should be preaching that Jesus was betrayed for the price of a servant. This is usually the verse people use to say a servant was worth 30 pieces of silver in the old law, and so that's the price of which. That's not what's being taught here. That is not the worth of the servant. That is payment or someone being, I can't think of the word, you know, when you lose something, being reimbursed, thank you, or recompensated for loss of productivity. That's not the worth of the servant. I think we ought not to preach that about Judas' betrayal of our Lord.
Jeremy Smith.
excellent job. I really like the fact that you talked about that there is a major difference and they're not equal between slavery of the Bible and slavery system that we have in the United States. And I was kind of wondering, as you studied this out, you know, as slavery became a very profitable thing in this country, and you know, we could have a big argument about what the Civil War was about, and depend on whether you ask somebody from the North or the South which way it went. But it really was an economical issue. That's really one of the biggest reasons why the war ended up being fought. But as that happened, and Lincoln especially began to try to, President Lincoln tried to get the Emancipation Proclamation passed, there were people on both sides, some using some of these passages that were just used in the South that were saying it's fine to have slavery because the Bible says it, and it's okay for me to, you know, hit them, all those types of things that you were talking about. And then there were people on the other side, the abolitionists, that were arguing other things. I was just curious if you, in your study, if you came across any debates or arguments that tied in with what you presented this evening.
Yeah, a lot. I read a lot of material on this exact issue, because it is true that both Northerners and Southerners use the Bible to defend or oppose the practice of slavery. And I think ultimately what it comes down to is the people who defended New World slavery with the Bible had a gross misunderstanding of what slavery was like, especially in the Old Testament. And so most of their arguments went something like this. Abraham, the father of faith, had servants. And there's no evidence that that was wrong for Abraham. And then when God gave a written law, he said it was okay for them to have slaves in Israel. And when Jesus and the apostles came around, they didn't really have a problem with it. They seemed to be okay with it. So why should we oppose it? Why should we say that we are under a tighter moral strictness than Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and Paul? That's basically how they argued. And I think that's absolutely ludicrous, because it's a total lack of any kind of understanding of the slavery in the old world, the slavery in Israel, and really what the Bible actually says. And a lot of the abolitionist preachers emphasized that. They emphasized that the slavery in the Bible is nothing like the slavery as it's being practiced in America. And quite a few of them made the kidnapping argument. And I personally, that seals the deal for me. The kidnapping argument to me, I think, is the most conclusive to say the practice that was here is nothing like what the Bible, you know, might tolerate. And I don't even like saying that the Bible condones slavery, because I don't even know that that's necessarily true. I think God allowed it. He tolerated it. But I don't think I think it was always less than ideal for him, for the Lord. I think it was always less than ideal. I think it was always less than ideal for the apostles. But this was the situation they were in, and their ultimate conclusion was, no matter what, you can be a Christian. And that's what was important to them.
Then we got time for a quick one. Very quick one.
Well, even in the New Testament, he tells them, do not become the slaves of men.
Yeah.
So the whole point is he didn't want this to continue.
Yeah.
Just a comment. If you want something interesting about abolitionists overseas, is the movie Amazing Grace. It has a lot of good stuff. Question. Could it be, then, what you were talking about, the price, if a slave got injured by his master, that under normal circumstances, if you will, yes, the owner would be losing money. But if that is the suggestion of that passage, what about the idea that if this slave is injured in some way, perhaps for an extended period of time, his time in this relationship would be extended until he got enough, well enough, in order to, you know, pay himself out of this situation. Could it be that the language here is suggesting that if a master hurts his slave, the slave is not obligated during that period of time to repay something he had no power over. In other words, if the master hurt him,
could
the language, and I was just wondering if you considered that, could it be that the language is saying if you hurt a slave and he's unable to pay you back, this is not tacked down at the end of his thing, but you have to bear the cost of whatever you did.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if that could be, did you come up
with that? I think that is the idea. I think the idea is, if you do this, this is foolish, why would you do this? If you do this, you're losing money. The master is losing money. But no matter what, in the seventh year Jubilee, all servants went free in Israel. So no matter how, you know, if you were so injured that you were down for 6 months, that didn't mean that when the Jubilee year rolled around, he got to keep you for an extra 6 months. So when the Jubilee, which were set years, when the Jubilee year came around, all servants were supposed to be released, and they were supposed to be provided for by their masters who were releasing them of their own goods, as we read from Leviticus 25, I think it was. So I think that the whole idea is not that this is how much a human being is worth. The idea has nothing to do with worth. It has to do with productivity. And the master is going to lose if he does something reckless that he ought not to do. And ultimately, I always go back to the Deuteronomy passage that says, you know, if you're being oppressed, run away. Run away. Just run away. And the neighbor down the road was commanded to take you in. So you're oppressed, you run away, you go jot a quarter mile down the road to the next farmhouse, and you find another Israelite, and you say, I've got an oppressive master, I need protection, and he's commanded to take you in and to shelter you and to let you stay wherever you want in the house, the law actually says. So there was a lot of built-in protection for the Israelite servants.
Any brief closing statement?
Thank you very much.